So our next storyteller, so we wanted someone from NASA. And we were like brainstorming. We were like, NASA, space telescope. These things are around us, right? So, but you would be surprised at how, like, many, you know, basically people we had to go through until we found a story. Because scientists do research. They don't necessarily love to tell stories. And so we feel very excited to have Joel Green here tonight because he has a story to share with you. And please welcome him.
Hi, everyone. I can't see anything. This is great. Okay. So I'm going to tell a little bit of a story about how I became an astronomer. When I was a kid, and you may not guess this by looking at me, but I liked science fiction. I know this is a shock. I used to read books like Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, and I used to play computer games called Master of Orion, which was made here in Baltimore, by the way. And I used to watch, and this is really going to shock you, a lot of Star Trek, the Next Generation. I want to clarify that. I remember an episode where Captain Picard is trying to explain to a less advanced alien culture that, you know, and it's sufficiently advanced technology is seems indistinguishable from magic, but was invented by a people just like them, us. So does that mean that we're on this trajectory to Star Trek? Are we going to make these kind of technological advances and explore the universe? So I was really interested to find out, so I went to school to study that, except, of course, at first I thought I was going to be a history major. So, you know, I really like studying ancient civilizations, and I love the telling the art of stories and learning about the past, but it turns out I'm incredibly bad at dealing with dead people's diaries and weird languages, and so that was a bad career choice. So I switched to something where I turned out I had a little bit more talent, which was math and physics, and I became an astronomer. And I remember early in my graduate school career when I was with a whole group of my drunk colleagues watching the NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope prepare for launch and go up in space. And basically, there was my thesis. It was either going to go up in triumph or in smoke. And fortunately, it was triumph, and that was great. So then I was able to get a PhD and stand before you today. So now I'm a professional astronomer. And when people find that out, they have a lot of interesting comments that they typically make to me, and I'd like to review a few of them with you now. The first is many people will say things like, "Huh, I've never met an astronomer before." That's actually not surprising. There's only about 10,000 astronomers in the world, professional astronomers, and you know that's fewer than rock stars. So. Okay, great. You know, most people don't actually know what an astronomer is, or even worse, if I use the scarier but very similar meaning term, astrophysicist. That's how you shut down a conversation. You say you're an astrophysicist. So a lot of people will say things like, "Hey, can you read my future in my palm?" To which I say, "No." A lot of people will ask if I want to go into space. And I'll tell you, I get sick in the backseat of a bumpy car ride, so I don't think any astronaut in a spinning capsule launching at escape velocity is going to want me anywhere near them. So let's just say no. A lot of people are really concerned about things like black holes. Also, the heat death of the universe seems to bother a lot of people. I can understand these concerns, okay. I freely admit that. But what most commonly people will, especially this year, people will come up to me and demand in a kind of aggressive or almost angry tone, why is Pluto not a planet anymore? Right? I wasn't at that meeting. I didn't vote. So don't blame me. But the point, they're asking the wrong question anyway, right? The question you should be asking, I hope, is what is a planet? Okay, that's a much better question. And that one we can answer because we have telescopes like NASA's Hubble and James Webb Space Telescopes, both of which the science is operated from the institute where I work, the Space Telescope Science Institute just down the road in Baltimore. And we can answer questions like that now. I can answer questions like that now. Okay. So a lot of people think that astronomers are fascinated by the night sky. And I think many are. But I grew up outside of New York City, and there wasn't actually a lot to see there. It wasn't that pretty. It wasn't really until I went to really dark locations like Arizona or Hawaii that I was really able to, really appreciate the beauty of the sky. That's not what drew me into it. And again, this is not going to surprise you, but I like science fiction. I like galactic empires. I like, you know, weird exotic worlds. I like strange alien species. I want to know what's on those dots. What was out there, right? And so I got into planet construction. That's right, construction and destruction. I study the formation and birth and destruction of planets around our galaxy. Planets like ours are born around stars like our sun in groups of hundreds or even thousands from these big clouds of hydrogen gas that are collapsing on themselves. And inside that gas is just tiny little dust grains, smaller than grains of sand, but so many of them that they can turn into these massive structures. And the planets just form as little crumbs around those collapsing cores that are making stars. So our sun formed 4.6 billion years ago, and the Earth and all the other planets in our solar system formed about a few million years after. The thing is, if you watch Star Trek, and I do, you might think that there's life everywhere. You know, that every planet they run into is teeming with aliens. If you look around our own solar system, allow me to give you a quick review. Mercury is about 700 degrees on the warm side and freezing on the cold side. Venus rains acid. Mars basically doesn't have air and global dust storms. And Jupiter doesn't even have a surface, so good luck. So which is it, right? I mean, is the universe full of life, or are we alone? So I do a lot of observing, okay? I've been out to places, and a lot of my observing is in the highest and driest places. That's where the really impressive telescopes are on the ground. And so I do a lot of observing in Hawaii, and everyone says, oh, great, Hawaii, that's a tropical paradise. I'm so jealous. And I admit, Hawaii is beautiful, and I had a great time there. But my experience in Hawaii is a little bit different than that of a typical tourist, and I'm just going to paint a quick picture for you. When I go to Hawaii, I stay up all night so that I can, you know, do nighttime observing, so I don't really see the sun. The summit of Mauna Kea, where the telescopes are, is around 14,000 feet altitude, so it's obviously very dark. It's extremely cold. It's below freezing a lot of the time, so there's sometimes snow. It's very, very dry and barren, so it looks like the surface of Mars. And there's not that much oxygen, so I make some very interesting scientific decisions at that altitude. And the saddest thing, actually, is that the low oxygen makes the cones in my eyes not work as well, so the night sky doesn't appear as impressive as you would think. Unless you take a hit of oxygen off one of the tanks, then I can tell you it looks pretty impressive. And oxygen, nothing else. Anyway, you have to picture me hanging kind of over the surface of a 10-foot-high railing, piping liquid helium, which is a few degrees above absolute zero, and I have a little face mask for this, into a giant metal thermos bottle at 7 a.m. after having done an entire night of observing, and you kind of get my picture of Hawaii. I really loved it. But one of the discoveries that I made while I was there, and have, you know, is that we discovered that planets are not always the first planets that you started with. So solar systems sometimes engulf and destroy their own planets because the gas that's still rushing in could force them inside. And we've seen evidence of this in real time. I've watched stars flare to 100 times in brightness with those same telescopes in Hawaii and fade back as if they had just grabbed about a Jupiter's mass worth of material. Which is a pretty amazing idea because, by the way, don't worry, it's not going to happen here. It'd be very early on. But it's an amazing idea to think that our solar system, the one we're living in now, was not the first iteration, but the last one to survive the last little cataclysmic burst. So what I realized is, so when I watch Star Trek, I notice some kind of funny things. There's an episode where the Enterprise goes to visit a T'Tari system. I was so excited when Captain Picard said T'Tari stars because I study T'Tari stars. They're young stars. That's amazing. Everything in the episode is totally wrong. And that's when I realized that I know more than the characters on Star Trek. Like, quite a bit more. I get to work with the greatest telescopes in the world every day. And I must be pretty terrible to hang out with at a science fiction movie. The thing is, though, when we look at these systems, this is an amazing question for me, this burning question of what is a typical solar system like? And if I were on the bridge of the Enterprise and I were surveying one of these systems, how would I describe our own home solar system? And would I expect to find that elsewhere? What is that saying about the universe at large? And can we answer a question like that for real? And the answer is that as an astronomer, I now know we can, or we at least take a good crack at it. And I can tell you that I can be involved in the development of a telescope that can do that. It's got to be a big telescope. We got to shoot it into space, but we can make a telescope that can look for Earths around the nearest 600 stars, if there are any to be found, analyze the gases in their atmospheres, and see if there's an effect from, say, a biotic life form. It's an intriguing possibility. It's a difficult technology. It could take 20 years to implement and launch, but I think it's worth it. So the last thought I'll leave you with. So Star Trek is about high-minded ideals. It's about exploring the universe. It's about grappling with moral dilemmas that we as a civilization haven't even gotten to yet. It's about exploration. And that's what the Hubble and James Webb Space Telescopes are all about. And the idea that a Star Trek episode could someday be inspired by something I do is probably the most terrifying thing I've ever thought about. So thank you.